We spend so much of our time obsessing over specs. When I'm looking at a new laptop, I see the gigahertz, the terabytes, the RAM.
Right.
And I know that, bigger numbers are generally better. But if I'm being honest, there's a big gap between knowing the numbers and actually understanding the mechanics.
Oh, absolutely.
Like I press a key, a letter appears. Simple. But the logic, the sheer amount of work for that one tiny action is just staggering.
It's the black box problem, isn't it? We treat them like magic appliances. You put an input in, you get an output, and you really try not to think about the sausage making inside.
Exactly. But today, we are breaking open that black box. We're doing a deep dive into a hardware and operating systems essential study guide.
And I know what you're thinking. Study guide sounds a little dry.
It sounds like we're back in college cramming for finals, yeah. But this document is actually, it's more like a treasure map.
It really is. It deconstructs the entire digital world, starting from, the microscopic transistors in the CPU and zooming all the way out to the global cloud.
So our mission for this deep dive is pretty simple. We want to understand the anatomy of digital thinking. We're going to trace a single thought from the silicon brain all the way to the network edge.
And this really matters because when you understand that a loading bar isn't just a timer, but it's like a struggle between your hard drive and your RAM,
Right.
or why your fan suddenly spins up when you open one specific program, you stop being just a passive user. You start becoming an operator.
So let's get into the surgery. I think we have to start with the brain, the CPU.
The central processing unit. But even calling it a brain is a bit of a metaphor. It's really more of a relentless high-speed calculator.
Right. The guide breaks it down. It's not just one big blob of silicon. You've got the ALU and the CU.
Correct. The ALU is the arithmetic logic unit. That's the muscle. It does all the math addition, subtraction, and all the logic, the ANDs, ORs, not Ts.
It's everything. Every video game, every spreadsheet, it all boils down to that.
It boils down to the ALU doing incredibly basic math at blinding speeds.
And the CU is the manager.
The control unit, yep, it's the traffic cop. It directs the flow of data, tells the memory where to go, and tells the ALU what to calculate next.
Okay, now here is where the guide added a layer that I hadn't really thought about before. We usually just stop at clock speed and cores. But for the CPU to actually process anything, it needs to hold the data somewhere. And I'm not even talking about RAM yet.
You're talking about registers.
Yes.
The
This
registers.
is such a crucial concept. Registers are the absolute fastest storage in a computer, but they are just tiny.
So how should we think about them?
Think of the CPU as a craftsman. RAM is the tool shed across the yard, the registers. That's what's in his actual hands.
So the accumulator, one of the key registers mentioned in the guide, is literally holding the number being worked on right now.
Precisely. If you're adding 2 plus 2, the twos are sitting right there in the registers. The CPU can't work on data that's way over in RAM. It has to have it in its hands.
And to keep those hands busy, we have this idea of pipelining. The guy describes it like an assembly line. It is. Without pipelining, the CPU would do one thing at a time: fetch an instruction, decode it, execute it, then start over. Fetch, decode, execute. It's inefficient.
Because while it's executing one thing, the fetch part of the processor is just sitting there idle.
Exactly. Pipelining means while one instruction is being executed, the next one is already being decoded, and the one after that is being fetched. It overlaps everything, so all parts of the CPU are working constantly. That's how we get this massive throughput.
Speaking of throughput, we have to talk about heat. The guide mentions TDP thermal design power. We sort of hit a wall with raw speed, haven't we? We can't just keep cranking up the gigahertz.
We can. I mean, physics is the limit here. When you switch those tiny transistors on and off billions of times a second, you generate heat. Go too fast, the chip literally melts.
Which is why we moved to multi-core processor.
It's the only way. Instead of one super fast brain, you have four or eight or 16 slightly slower brains all working in tandem. It's the only way to boost performance without, setting your desk on fire.
Okay, so we have the brain. And it has these tiny registers in its hands. But it needs more data than it can hold. This brings us to cache memory, L1, L2, L3.
This is the hierarchy of proximity. It's all about how close the data is.
I love the analogy the guide uses, but I want to push on it a bit. So L1 cache is super fast, it's right there on the chip. L2 is a bit bigger, L3 bigger still. The way out there, you have RAM.
Right.
So my question is, and I bet a lot of people wonder this, if L1 cache is so incredibly fast, why do we even bother with RAM? Why is the whole computer just made of cache?
That is the billion-dollar question, and the answer is twofold: density and cost. SRAM static RAM, which is what cache is made of, is incredibly complex. It takes up a lot of physical space on the silicon.
So it's a real estate problem.
It is. To make, say, 16 gigabytes of L1 cache, your CPU would have to do the size of a dinner plate, and it would cost as much as a car.
So we compromise.
We compromise. We use the desk analogy. Registers are your hands. L1 cache is the notepad right in front of you.
Yeah.
L2 is maybe the pile of papers on the corner of your desk. L3 is the desk drawer.
And RAM.
RAM is the filing cabinet across the room.
And the hard drive.
That's a warehouse 3 miles away.
Wow. That scale really puts it in perspective. When the CPU has to go all the way to the hard drive, it's not just a little slower. In computer time, it's an eternity.
It's the difference between you blinking your eye and you waiting a month for a package to be delivered. That's why more cache makes a computer feel so snappy. You're just buying a bigger desk so you don't have to run to the filing cabinet as often.
Let's talk about that filing cabinet then. RAM, random access memory.
The volatile workspace.
Volatile meaning.
Yeah.
You cut the power, the data just poof. It's gone.
Exactly. It's temporary. We're on DDR5 now, which is just the latest standard for speed and efficiency. But the fundamental problem is always capacity.
I am so guilty of this. I'm a tab hoarder. I'll have 50 browser tabs open. What is actually happening physically when I run out of RAM?
Your computer starts to lie to you. It uses something called virtual memory. It takes the data you aren't using right this second, maybe that tab you haven't looked at in an hour, and it writes it to the hard drive. Into a special swap file.
It sends it to the warehouse.
But it pretends it's still in the filing cabinet. So when you click on that old tab, there's that little delay. That's your computer literally sprinting to the warehouse to fetch the data back.
That explains that thrashing sound my old laptop used to make.
Yeah.
It was just constantly reading and writing from the disk.
And that brings us to what used to be the biggest bottleneck in computing history, the hard drive.
HDD versus SSD. We all know SSDs are faster, but the guide gets into the mechanics of why.
With an HDD, a spinning hard drive, you have a physical arm that has to literally move across a spinning platter to find a piece of data. That seek time is a real physical delay.
It's a record player. You have to move the needle to the right groove.
Exactly. An SSD, a solid state drive, is just flash memory. No moving parts. The controller just says, give me the data at address X, and the electricity is there, you know, instantly.
So upgrading from an HDD to an SSD isn't just a luxury. It removes the single slowest mechanical link in the entire chain.
It is the single most impactful upgrade you can make to an older machine, period.
But drives fail.
Oh.
And the guide spends a good amount of time on RAID, the redundant array of independent disks. This feels like enterprise-level stuff, but I actually use this at home on my media server.
It's crucial for anyone who really values their data. RAID is just about combining multiple drives to get either more speed or more safety.
So let's run through the main types. RAID 0 is striping.
Right. Imagine writing a sentence, but you write every other word on a different drive. You can write the whole sentence twice as fast.
But if you lose one of those drives...
You've got half a sentence. The data is garbage. You lose everything. Zero redundancy.
Then you have RAID 1. That's mirroring.
Simple. You write the full sentence on both drives. It's not any faster, but if one drive goes up in smoke, you have a perfect backup ready to go instantly.
And RAID 5. That's the tricky one.
RAID 5 is the mathematical magic trick. You stripe the data across, say, three or more drives, but you also write a special parity bit. It's like a mathematical clue.
Clue for what?
If any one of those drives fails, the controller can look at the remaining drives and the parity clues, do the math backwards, and figure out what must have been on the missing drive.
It reconstructs the ghost data. That is incredibly cool.
It is. Until a second drive fails while you're in the middle of rebuilding, then you're in real trouble.
A fair point.
Yeah.
Okay, we built the machine. CPU... RAM, storage. Now we need to connect it all together. The nervous system, the motherboard.
The backbone of the whole operation.
Now the guide mentions the North Bridge and the South Bridge chipsets. But reading this, I kind of felt like, wait, is this still how it works?
Ah, that's a great catch.
My understanding was that modern CPUs have sort of swallowed a lot of this functionality.
You are spot on. Historically, you had these two distinct chips. The North Bridge handled the fast stuff, CPU, RAM, graphics. The South Bridge handled the slow stuff, your USD, audio, all that.
But speed demands proximity, right?
Exactly. To reduce that latency, modern CPU architectures have integrated the North Bridge functions directly onto the CPU die itself.
So the motherboard is getting simpler.
The motherboard is getting simpler because the CPU is becoming more complex. The concept of fast lanes and slow lanes still exists, but physically, the North Bridge is now just part of the processor.
And sitting on top of all this hardware, you have the operating system, the manager.
The OS is the great resource allocator. Its most important job is process management.
This is where we get into preemptive multitasking, which sounds like a military strategy.
It sort of is. In the old days, operating systems used cooperative multitasking. The OS would politely ask a program, hey, are you done with the CPU yet? And it had to trust the program to say yes.
And if the program was badly written or crashed?
It would just hoard the CPU and freeze the entire computer.
I remember those days.
Preemptive multitasking means the OS is a dictator. It says, you get 5 milliseconds, time's up, now you get 5 milliseconds. It forces the switch.
So the illusion that I'm running Spotify and Word and a browser all at once is just the OS switching between them so fast I can't even tell?
Exactly. It's a master juggler.
Now, a huge part of modern computing is virtualization. The guide talks about hypervisors.
This is really the foundation of the cloud. A hypervisor is software that lets you run multiple fake computers, virtual machines, or VMs, on one single piece of physical hardware.
But there's a catch with that, isn't there? The noisy neighbor problem.
Right. If you're renting a VM in the cloud, you are sharing the physical CPU and RAM with other customers. If one of them suddenly decides to, I don't know, calculate pi to a trillion digits,
they can hog all the resources.
They hog the resources and your computer slows down to a crawl even though you aren't doing anything heavy.
And that's why containers are taking over. Things like Docker or Kubernetes. How is that different from a virtual machine?
Okay, think of a virtual machine like a standalone house. It has its own foundation, its own plumbing, its own heating. It's heavy and it takes a while to build.
And a container.
A container is an apartment in a high-rise. You share the foundation and the plumbing, that's the OS kernel, with everyone else. You just have your own walls.
So it's much lighter.
Much lighter, way faster to spin up, and a lot more efficient. It's perfect for modern apps.
Okay, let's zoom out. We've left the physical box. We are on the network.
The communication layer.
I want to clarify the hardware here, because people use these words interchangeably. Hubs, switches, and routers. They are very different animals.
Very different. A hub is basically a relic. It's a dumb device. If data comes in one port, the hub just screams it out of every single other port.
It's like shouting in an office.
Exactly. You're shouting a message to everyone just to reach one person. Total chaos. A switch is smart. It learns the MSE addresses, the physical ID cards of all the devices connected to it.
So it knows who's who.
Right. So when data comes in, it whispers it directly to the intended recipient. No shouting.
And the router.
The router is the gateway. It connects your local network, your LAN, to the outside world, the WAN. It's the traffic cop for the internet.
And once we're on the internet, we're dealing with protocols, TCP and UDP.
The rules of the road.
I always think of TCP as the anxious micromanager of protocols.
That's a fair description. TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, is connection-oriented. It sends a packet and then waits for an acknowledgement. Did you get that? Good. Did you get the next one? No. Okay, I'll resend it. It guarantees delivery.
Which is great for an email or a web page. You don't want half an email.
Mm-hmm.
But UDP is different.
UDP, User Datagram Protocol, is the fire and forget method. It just blasts out a stream of data. It doesn't check to see if it all arrived.
How would you ever want that?
Speed. Think about a Zoom call or a live video stream. If one tiny packet of audio gets lost, you don't want the whole call to freeze while the computer asks for it to be resent.
You'd rather have a tiny glitch.
You just skip that split second of audio and keep going. Real-time applications need UDP.
Okay, we're connected. We're in the cloud. And the guide throws a lot of acronyms at us. IS, PIS, SaaS.
The as-a-service models?
The classic way to explain this is the pizza analogy, so let's try it. On-premises, traditional IT, that's making a pizza from scratch at home. You own the oven, the ingredients, everything.
Correct. You're responsible for everything from the fire to the cheese.
Then IaaS infrastructure as a service, that's like renting a commercial kitchen.
Exactly. A provider like AWS gives you the building, the gas, the ovens, the servers, and the storage. But
yeah.
You still have to bring the ingredients, the software, and bake the pizza yourself.
Okay. Then pizza's platform as a service. Is that like buying a frozen pizza?
In a way, yeah. The environment is all ready for you. The crust and sauce are there. That's the operating system and development tools. You just throw on your specific toppings, your code, and bake it.
And sauce software as a service.
That's just ordering Domino's.
Right. You don't know what oven they used.
Yeah.
You don't care about their gas bill. You just open the box and eat the pizza. That's your Gmail, your Dropbox, your Salesforce.
Yeah.
But someone still has to bake that pizza. And that brings us to the stacks. The guide contrasts the old Lampy stack with the modern Means stack.
This is really the shift from the old web to the modern web. Lampy Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, that was the backbone of the internet for 20 years.
And the key part there was MySQL, a structured database, rows and columns.
Right. But think about modern data. It's tweets, user comments, images, sensor logs. It's messy. It doesn't fit neatly into a spreadsheet.
And that's why NoSQL took off.
Exactly. Yeah. The Means stack uses MongoDB, which is a NoSQL database. It stores data in flexible documents, not rigid tables. It allows for the messy reality of big data to just exist without breaking everything.
Okay, so we have this incredible journey. Data starts in the registers, moves to RAM, gets stored on an SSD, sliced up by the OS, routed over the internet, and processed in the cloud. But it's a dangerous world out there.
Security. The immune system.
I want to trace a threat. Let's say a bad packet tries to get into our system. What's the first thing it hits?
First, it hits the firewall. That's the bouncer at the club. It checks the ID, the port and the IP address. If port 80 for web traffic is open, it gets through. If port 23 for telnet is closed, it gets bounced.
But what if it's a valid-looking packet, but it's carrying a malicious payload? Like a buffer overflow attack?
This connects all the way back to what we said about registers and RAM. A buffer overflow is when a malicious program deliberately sends too much data to a specific spot in memory.
It overfills the cup.
It overfills the cup, and the liquid spills over into the neighboring memory addresses. Hackers use that spillover to overwrite the return address, basically tricking the CPU into jumping to the hacker's malicious code instead of the legitimate program.
That is terrifyingly clever. So how do we catch something like that?
That's where IDS and IPS come in. An intrusion detection system, an IDS, watches traffic patterns. If it sees a weird spillover attempt, it sounds an alarm. An intrusion prevention system, an IPS, goes a step further and actively cuts the connection.
What if they do get in? The guide mentions rootkits.
That's the worst case scenario. A rootkit digs itself deep into the OS kernel, or even the firmware of the computer itself. It hides underneath the antivirus software.
So it can lie to the system.
It can tell the OS everything is fine, nothing to see here, while it's quietly stealing all your data.
So the base defense is something called hardening.
Hardening is basically reducing your attack surface. Turn off the ports you weren't using. Patch your firmware so those buffer overflow vulnerabilities get fixed. You just make the target as small and as tough as possible.
You know, getting to the end of this, I'm really struck by how physical this all is. We talk about the cloud like it's some kind of magic mist, but it's really just hot metal, spinning fans, and light pulsing through glass cables.
It is, and there's a real fragility to it. A single bit flipping in a memory module, a fan failing in a server farm, a deep sea cable being cut. It all relies on these layers of abstraction holding up perfectly.
Which brings me to a thought I've been mulling over. We're moving towards serverless computing. We're moving to AI that literally writes its own code.
We are abstracting the abstraction.
Exactly. We are getting further and further away from the registers and the logic gates. Do you think we're in danger of losing the art of the machine?
I think it creates a dangerous divide. For 99% of people, the computer is becoming a magic wand. You just wave it and things happen. But for the 1% who understand the registers, who understand the network protocols and the kernel vulnerabilities.
They hold the keys to the kingdom.
They absolutely do. If you don't understand how the oven works, you are entirely at the mercy of the person who cooks your pizza.
That is a very sobering thought. Being an operator isn't just about geek cred. It's about autonomy.
Ideally, yes. The more you know about what's inside the black box, the less likely you are to get trapped inside it.
Well, I'm certainly going to look at my laptop fan with a little more respect today. Thanks for guiding us through the Silicon Jungle.
My pleasure. It was fun.
And thank you for listening to this deep dive. Keep those registers clear, and we'll see you next time.